Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Mixed Motive Instruction Edition. Today our featured guest is Jones Day attorney Shai Dvoretsky, discussing Gross v. FBL Financial Services, heard an oral argument on Tuesday, March 31st, 2009. Thanks for tuning in. The Supreme Court here considers the kind of evidence needed in a case of mixed motive non-Title VII discrimination. Petitioner Jack Gross sued his employer, respondent FBL, under the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, alleging that he was demoted in 2003 on account of his age. The district judge at trial gave a mixed motive instruction under which Gross only had to show that age was a, quote, motivating factor to prevail unless FBL could prove it would have made the demotion even without considering his age. The jury found in favor of Gross, but the Eighth Circuit overturned the jury verdict on appeal, reasoning that mixed motive instructions in cases of non-Title VII discrimination can only be given if the plaintiff offers, quote, direct evidence of discrimination. The Supreme Court now considers what kind of evidence a plaintiff must present to obtain a mixed motive instruction in such cases. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Dvoretsky.
The Supreme Court heard argument on March 31st in Gross v. FBL Financial Group, an important case concerning the burden of proof in cases under the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. The plaintiff, Jack Gross, argued that his supervisor demoted him because of his age. Gross's theory of the case was, first of all, that there was no reason for his demotion, so it must have been because of age, and second, that other employees in his department over the age of 50 who had positions similar to his were also demoted at the same time. Gross's employer, FBL, argued that Gross's supervisor reassigned Gross to a position that better fit his skills and abilities, and that age had nothing to do with that reassignment. The case therefore turned on whether FBL's explanation for Gross's reassignment was pretextual, that is, on whether or not Gross's supervisor should be believed about his true motive for reassigning Gross. At the end of trial, the district court charged the jury that Gross had to prove that his age was a motivating factor in the decision to demote him, and that age could be a motivating factor if it played a part or a role in the decision to demote him. The district court further instructed the jury that the verdict has to be for the defendant if the defendant proved by a preponderance of the evidence that it would have demoted Gross regardless of age. FBL proposed instructions in which Gross would have had to prove that his age was a determining factor, not just a motivating factor in his demotion. The Eighth Circuit reversed the jury's finding in favor of the plaintiff. Interpreting Justice O'Connor's separate concurring opinion in the Supreme Court case of Price Waterhouse v. Hopkins, which I'll discuss in a moment, the Eighth Circuit held that the district court erred in using a so-called mixed motive instruction. The Eighth Circuit held that the burden of persuasion on the issue of causation may shift to the defendant only if the plaintiff first shows by direct evidence that age played a substantial role in the employment decision. The Eighth Circuit defined direct evidence as evidence that shows a specific link between age bias and the challenged decision, not just stray remarks in the workplace, statements by non-decision makers, or statements by decision makers that are unrelated to the challenged employment decision itself. Before getting into the Supreme Court proceedings in this case, let me first say a word about the Price Waterhouse decision. In Price Waterhouse, two multi-member decision-making bodies, the Admissions Committee and the Policy Board of the Price Waterhouse Partnership, were responsible for a decision about promotion that was challenged by the plaintiff. There was some evidence in the case that certain partners on the two committees reacted negatively to the plaintiff's personality because she was a woman and opposed her promotion on that ground. There was also evidence that other partners may have opposed the plaintiff's promotion for non-discriminatory reasons. The court in Price Waterhouse therefore faced a classic problem of multiple causation. There were multiple forces, some lawful and some unlawful, that may have caused the challenged employment action, and that made it unusually difficult for the plaintiff to prove which force was decisive. In that circumstance involving multiple forces, once the plaintiff proved that gender actually caused the action of one or more members of the decision-making committees, six out of the nine justices concluded that the defendant could avoid liability only if the defendant proved that it would have taken the same employment action even absent discrimination. There were three key opinions in Price Waterhouse. Justice Brennan, writing for a plurality of the court, spoke expressly in terms of multiple causation. he would have held that once the plaintiff proved that gender was an actual causative force in the employment action, the employer could prevail only by proving that it would have reached the same decision absent discrimination. Justice White concurred separately, and he would have decided the case under the Mount Healthy precedent. In Justice White's view, once the plaintiff proved that some unlawful bias was a substantial factor in the employment decision, the employer could defeat liability only by proving by a preponderance of the evidence that it would have reached the same decision even in the absence of the unlawful motive. Justice O'Connor's separate concurrence, which the Eighth Circuit held was controlling in this case, argued that the plaintiff had to show by direct evidence that an illegitimate criterion was a substantial factor in the decision. Once the plaintiff showed that, the employer could prevail only by carrying its burden of establishing an affirmative defense that it would have taken the same employment action, even absent impermissible forces. The Supreme Court briefing in this case turned largely on interpretations of Price Waterhouse. Petitioners' opening and reply briefs focused on the question whether direct evidence, which the petitioner contrasted with circumstantial evidence, is necessary for a mixed motive instruction shifting the burden of persuasion to the employer under Price Waterhouse. But the Eighth Circuit didn't contrast direct with circumstantial evidence, and that's not the line that the respondent in this case was advancing either. Respondent argued first for overruling Price Waterhouse altogether and holding that the burden of persuasion should never shift to the employer to disprove age discrimination. In the alternative, respondent argued that if the Supreme Court retains Price Waterhouse, that only a substantial showing of unlawful motivation would suffice to shift the burden of persuasion to the employer, and that here the district court allowed the jury to shift the burden of persuasion as long as age played some role. The Chamber of Commerce, which my firm represented before the Supreme Court, filed an amicus brief making two basic points. First, the Chamber of Commerce argued that under Price Waterhouse, the mixed motive instruction shifting the burden of persuasion to the employer is an affirmative defense to be invoked by the employer only if it wishes. To make that point more concrete, in a typical case, an employer will argue that age played no role whatsoever in the challenged employment decision. In the alternative, the employer might also argue as an affirmative defense that even if age played a role, that the employer would have taken the same employment decision anyway. In this case, however, FBL chose not to assert that affirmative defense. FBL argued to the jury only that age played no role whatsoever in the employment decision. In that circumstance, where the employer did not even invoke the affirmative defense, it would have been a mistake for the district court to shift the burden of persuasion to the employer. The Chamber of Commerce's second principal point was that Price Waterhouse has to be understood in context. Price Waterhouse was a decision involving a multi-member decision-making body, not just a single company supervisor or manager. Therefore, rather than presenting a binary question of intent, as many age discrimination cases do, Price Waterhouse presented the fact finder with a complex problem of multiple causation. Which of the multiple grounds, both discriminatory and non-discriminatory, on which individual members of the particular committees at issue, was decisive in producing the challenged employment decision? In that limited context, the six justices forming the majority in Price Waterhouse concluded that once a plaintiff proves that unlawful bias was a substantial factor, the defendant is entitled to an affirmative defense against liability if it shows that it would have taken the same employment action anyway. This case, however, was a quintessential single decision maker pretext case in which the central issue was whether or not the non-discriminatory explanation for the challenged employment action by Gross's supervisor was to be believed. In that context, the Price Waterhouse framework just doesn't apply. In fact, allowing Price Waterhouse to apply in this context would essentially swallow the ordinary rule in age discrimination cases that the plaintiff bears the burden of persuasion at all times. In just about every single decision maker case like this one, a plaintiff could argue that mixed motives were at play in the sense that the decision maker may have been thinking about multiple things. That's not the sort of multiple causation context in which Price Waterhouse arose. The oral argument in this case, I think, told us very little about how the case is likely to come out. Several justices gave us very few clues about what they might be thinking. Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Stevens all said little or nothing. Justices Souter and Ginsburg's questions suggested that they thought the only question properly before the court was whether direct evidence is necessary to shift the burden of persuasion to the employer. Their question suggested that they thought the source of that requirement was solely Justice O'Connor's separate opinion in Price Waterhouse, and that that opinion was not controlling. Chief Justice Roberts seemed to latch on to the point that the employer in this case did not invoke the affirmative defense provided by Price Waterhouse, and he appeared not willing to allow the burden of persuasion to shift in a case where the employer wasn't raising that defense. Justice Breyer seemed to suggest that as long as age played any role whatsoever in a decision, it was a motivating factor sufficient to shift the burden of persuasion to the employer. Not only would that view be inconsistent with the common law of torts and Price Waterhouse, but it would also be inconsistent with a line of cases in which the court has made clear that the plaintiff has to show that age not only played a role, but actually made a difference in the challenged employment decision. Justice Alito seemed focused on the argument that all single decision-maker cases effectively involve potential mixed motives, and that Price Waterhouse was dealing with a different conception of multiple causation, not just the multiple motives of a single person. It's unclear how the Supreme Court will sort through all of this, but we can expect a decision by the end of June.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.